Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
How did it come about?
Let's have a bit of history.
It is not black and white, is it?
That raises big questions.
There are repercussions around the world.
It's a hugely complicated picture.
The official narrative is somewhat different.
For a greater understanding of the stories affecting our lives, search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 13th of May, these are our main stories. Russian President Vladimir Putin has replaced his long-standing ally Sergei Shoigu as defence minister. A coalition of separatist parties in the Spanish region of Catalonia loses its majority after regional elections. And Tunisian police arrest a prominent lawyer and commentator, a moment captured live on TV. Also in this podcast.
I came to Italy and I followed in his footsteps and I could look at his paintings and his drawings and I could see the landscape even after all these years.
The geologist who claims to have solved the mystery of where the Mona Lisa was painted. Weeks after his resounding and entirely expected re-election as Russian president, Vladimir Putin is ringing the changes in the Kremlin hierarchy. He's replaced his longtime ally Sergei Shoigu, who's been defense minister since 2012 and a key player in Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov had this explanation for the change.
Andrei Belousov has been appointed Minister of Defence, as you know. Perhaps what is important to note is today on the battlefield, the winner is the one who is more open to innovation, more open to its implementation as quickly as possible. And therefore, it's natural that at the current stage, the president has decided to have a civilian as head of the Ministry of Defence.
For more on this and what it might mean, I've been talking to our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg. I began by asking him if, on the face of it, this was a straightforward demotion.
I think it's a demotion, yes. I mean, he's not out completely. He's being moved to the Russian Security Council, so, he still has a job. But I think, as far as Russian politics goes, that is a demotion. Sergei Shoigu had been defence minister for 12 years when he was appointed by Vladimir Putin back in 2012. The two men have been very close for some time. They used to go on holiday together, even to Siberia. And, you know, last week we were on Red Square watching the annual Victory Day parade, and Defence Minister Shoigu was there. He was taking part in the parade, inspecting the troops. But there had been rumours for some time now that his position had grown weaker. I mean, you know, although President Putin has been growing more confident about the way the war in Ukraine has been going for Russia, it did not go at all according to plan. This so-called special military operation that the Kremlin talks about was only supposed to take a few days, a few weeks maximum, back in 2022. It's now into its third year. So there had been talk for some time that Mr. Shoigu could lose his job, and that is exactly, I think, what is going to happen.
So what's going to change, particularly in regard to the war in Ukraine?
OK, well, the key point I think we have to make is that whoever the government ministers are in Russia, whoever sits around that cabinet table, there is one man and one man alone who calls the shots in Russia, and that is Vladimir Putin. This is a presidential system. The power is in the hands of the president, and it was his decision to start the war in Ukraine, to invade, to launch the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And all the big decisions are taken by him. Having said that, it is interesting when reshuffles happen in the government, particularly of the key ministers. It doesn't happen very often. You look at Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister. He's been doing the job, his job, for 20 years. And as I say, Mr. Shoigu had been defence minister for 12 years. But it is interesting that he is being replaced, it looks like, by an economist, Andrei Belousov. And I think that reflects the fact that over the last couple of years, the economy in Russia has been put on a war footing, and that President Putin wants a man who understands economic matters to be in the defence ministry.
Of course, there was a very public row between the head of the Wagner Group and Mr. Shoigu, which ended in the head of the Wagner Group dying in an untimely plane crash.
Yes, Mr. Prigozhin, you're absolutely right. And when that very public row was raging, President Putin took the side of Sergei Shoigu. So Mr. Prigozhin had demanded that Mr. Shoigu be replaced and sacked. That didn't happen because Vladimir Putin doesn't like being told what to do. He doesn't like giving in to pressure. So he took the side of Sergei Shoigu. And after the Wagner mutiny failed, it seemed as if Mr. Shoigu's position had strengthened considerably. But, you know, time has gone on and the rumours began that actually he had lost the support, the favour of the president to a large extent and would not hold on to his job for much longer. That's exactly what has happened.
Steve Rosenberg. Staying with the war, the commander of Ukraine's armed forces has warned that his troops are struggling to hold their positions in the northeastern region of Kharkiv after Russian forces launched a fresh assault last week. And the regional governor said that all areas of the northern border were under enemy fire almost constantly. Moscow claims to have captured another four villages after seizing five on Saturday. Our defence correspondent Jonathan Beale reports from Vovchansk in Kharkiv.
The town of Vovchansk was liberated in a surprise Ukrainian offensive less than 2 years ago. Now it's at risk of falling back into Russian hands again. There's a heavy artillery battle surrounding this Kharkiv town. Most of the population have already fled. Alexei, a local policeman, is telling the rest to leave. He says it's better than dying. The shelling is constant and chaotic, and it's all over the town. All that's left of Serhii's home is a burnt-out shell. He's the latest victim of a now familiar Russian tactic of reducing Ukrainian towns and villages to rubble. But Serhii says he can't leave. He needs to look after his goats. Now, his only worldly possessions. You can still hear the artillery battle going on. It was more intense yesterday. This devastation, one man's house, was created by a Russian glide bomb. And that's the sound of a jet somewhere. Ukraine's outgunned and outnumbered, and Russia's using aerial glide bombs to brutal effect. For some, it's made the decision to flee unavoidable. Though it's still heartbreaking for Alexander. He does the sign of the cross and tenderly touches the ground as he leaves the home he grew up in. But it's now simply too dangerous to stay.
It has never been like that before. Thousands of shells. The house was jumping, so that you understand, and now it jumped literally in front of you.
For something you've already fought for before in 2022. Same again. Angry?
Very angry.
Denis Yaroslavsky is the commander of a specialist Ukrainian reconnaissance unit. He believes this latest Russian offensive was avoidable if Ukraine had prepared better defences. He shows me video from a drone feed of Russian soldiers appearing to walk across the border unopposed. At the time, he watched it in disbelief.
There was no first line of defense. We saw it. The Russians just walked in. Where were the minefields? They just walked in.
Denis helped push back the Russians here in that surprise Ukrainian offensive in 2022. Now he and his men are being asked to do the same again. Ukrainian officials insist they were prepared for this latest Russian assault, but Kharkiv has exposed a weakness in Ukraine's defences.
Jonathan Beale. Israel may not be giving in to international pressure to stop its military incursion in Rafah in southern Gaza, but it is allowing more aid into the Palestinian territory. A new crossing has been opened in coordination with the United States. Israel said that dozens of trucks carrying flour from the World Food Programme have entered northern Gaza. In the south, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians have now left Rafah for the coast in anticipation of an Israeli attack. The UN human rights chief, Volker Turk, said that orders issued by Israel had sown chaos.
The latest evacuation orders affect close to 1 million people in Rafah. So where should they go now? There is no safe place in Gaza. These exhausted, famished people, many of whom have been displaced many times already, have no good options. Other towns across Gaza, including Khan Yunis, which is supposed to receive those who are being displaced from Rafah right now, have already been reduced to rubble and remained under attack. These are not safe places.
The US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that Israel lacked a credible plan to protect civilians in Rafah. I heard more from our diplomatic correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams.
We've had, once again, American officials, both Antony Blinken and the National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, being interviewed on American television today, essentially issuing the same warnings that we have heard from the Biden administration, very anxious, perhaps desperate, to prevent an all-out Israeli assault on the most populated areas of Rafah. There was also an interesting warning from Antony Blinken saying, and I'm quoting here, that Israel is on a trajectory to inherit an insurgency with many armed Hamas fighters left, or a vacuum filled by chaos, filled by anarchy, and probably refilled by Hamas. The Americans have noted that this weekend, the Israeli military returned to parts of the northern Gaza Strip, where they had already carried out operations many, many months ago. And in fact, four Israeli soldiers were killed in that fighting, suggesting that Hamas still has the ability to pop up in places where perhaps the Israelis thought that they had already dealt with the threat. So I think the warning is really don't do Rafah, and that Israel is in real danger of inheriting a very lawless, unpredictable situation throughout the Gaza Strip unless somehow it changes track.
So it may not be an all-out ground offensive in Rafah yet, but it's still a pretty serious military operation, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is. And, you know, it is already having very significant effects, not least the fact that as many as 300,000 people have already been forced to leave the Rafah area. Now, that is a little short of a quarter of the entire civilian population of the Rafah area. Most of the people who have left are people who had arrived to seek shelter in Rafah from other parts of the Gaza Strip further north in previous months. We're seeing these people moving west and north, filling up these already overcrowded areas along the coast where there is no sanitation, there's no running water. People essentially are having to fend for themselves, and it's becoming incredibly congested.
And as you indicate, still a huge humanitarian crisis, but there is a new crossing point into the Strip.
Yes, yeah, so this is what the Israelis are calling Western Erez. This is in the far northern part of the Gaza Strip, close to the Erez crossing, which in days before the war was the main civilian crossing point, but which the Israelis have been using for aid convoys in recent days. And the Israelis are saying that this crossing point will see the flow of additional aid into the north, where the conditions for civilians is arguably the worst of anywhere in the Gaza Strip, with the whole area teetering on the edge of starvation.
Paul Adams. A coalition of separatist parties in the Spanish region of Catalonia has lost its majority after Sunday's elections for the regional parliament. Separatists have governed there for a decade. The Socialist Party, which governs Spain nationally, is emerging as the biggest in the Catalan chamber, but would need to make alliances to govern. Our correspondent in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, gave us this update.
And this is certainly a very good result for the socialists of Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez. They've made gains on their last result from 3 years ago when they did actually win the election but were unable to form a government. They've performed even better than that. So this is a really good result for them. And Pedro Sanchez himself and his Socialist Party seem to see this very much as vindication of his policies in Catalonia, and in particular that very controversial amnesty law that he's pushed through benefiting Catalan separatists. So certainly Pedro Sanchez seems to feel vindicated, and this is very much a boost for him in general. The Catalan political landscape is very fragmented because they have this division between left and right, which you have across the rest of Spain, obviously. But also in Catalonia, what you have is the division between unionists and separatists. And so that complicates matters very much. And that has been the case for many years. But it's probably more fragmented now than it has been even before. You've got the socialists with a very clear victory, and yet it's not a given that they will be able to form a government, because in order to form a government, they would probably need the support of the Catalan Republican Left, who are a pro-independence party. Now, many people may feel that that's a likely alliance that will end up forming a government, but it's certainly not a given. So it's not going to be easy for the socialists to form a government. They won the election 3 years ago and were not able to do so. So I think the conversations that take place between the parties in the coming days and weeks are going to be lengthy and very complex.
Guy Hedgko. Still to come in the Global News Podcast.
He is back after his 29th successful summit, and he might go back for his 30th attempt this season. No wonder he's known as Everest Man.
The man who's climbed Mount Everest 29 times, and he's not stopping there.
So, how did it happen?
Well, actually, that's a really important question.
The two countries were essentially enemies.
That is, of course, an allegation that has been levelled.
Everybody had a different definition of what the problem was.
Let's remember the background of all this.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
We're finding out why.
What is the evidence?
Let's analyse it.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
A dramatic arrest captured on French TV.
On ne voit pas du tout ce qui se passe. Donc voilà, Sonia Darmanin est probablement en train d'être arrêtée.
This was the moment Tunisian lawyer and commentator Sonia Darmani was forcibly seized by hooded police in the capital Tunis. Her arrest was captured on camera during a live broadcast of France 24. Later that evening, two prominent Tunisian journalists were also detained. Ms. Darmani had been publicly critical of President Kais Saied's immigration policy and for, in her words, turning Tunisia into border guards for Europe. Dozens of lawyers, journalists and critics are being arrested under a 2022 law called Decree 54, which critics argue is used to crush dissent. Alicia Volkman is a journalist based in the Tunisian capital.
I would say this is actually a watershed moment, because up till now, the arrests of political critics of Kais Saied have always sort of taken place deep in the middle of the night with police sort of waiting outside somebody's house. This happened in a public place. The Bar Association is actually inside the Palace of Justice. The main court within Tunis is very significant. It shows a big shift in how emboldened the police and the new, more authoritarian regime actually is now. What we're already seeing is significant members of civil society being arrested on what seem to be trumped-up charges, such as Sadia Musba, who is the head of Menemti, which is a very important association. It's the association that pushed through the anti-racism law back in 2018. So it's not disconnected from Sonia's case, because both have been battling to expose the cruelty and abuses of the Tunisian state against black migrants. But both are a watershed moment, because this signals an increased level of audacity and impunity and confidence in terms of shutting down more critical voices, but also civil society that has been so strong since the 2011 revolution.
Freelance journalist Alicia Volkman. The fire season in Canada has started earlier than usual, forcing thousands of people in the western province of British Columbia to leave their homes. Fires are also burning in the neighbouring province of Alberta. The government in Ottawa is worried there could be a repeat of last summer when blazes got so out of control, 8 firefighters died in trying to tackle them. Stephanie Prentice has this report.
Canada may be used to wildfires, but last year's were its worst on record. More than 6,500 fires burned for months, covering 15 million hectares of land, seven times the annual average. Now some fear that pattern is starting again and early, with evacuation alerts across two provinces and major highways closed due to smoke. One large fire near Fort McMurray has been listed as out of control. Thousands of people have been ordered to leave their homes and helicopter pilots are monitoring the flames using night vision equipment. The federal government is warning Canadians that another catastrophic season could be ahead, with higher than normal spring and summer temperatures expected. A warmer than normal winter also saw what experts called zombie fires still smouldering under layers of snow, and the ground is now drier and more susceptible to catching a light than usual. The Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has met with fire chiefs and warned that people are worried about what summer may bring and what the future may hold.
Stephanie Prentice. To Australia now, a country which has, in recent years, created quite a name for itself as a producer of good wine. But right now, instead of flowing freely in homes and wine bars, half a billion litres of perfectly good red, white and rosé is sitting unused in storage tanks. That's because there's a global surplus of wine. Production is still going well, but fewer people are drinking it. In fact, the situation is so bad in Australia that farmers are giving up and destroying grapevines in order to grow something else. More from our Sydney correspondent, Phil Mercer.
In inland regions of Australia, where most of this country's bulk wine is produced, prices for grapes have fallen by more than 50% over the past few years. Growers here have had to diversify, trying to sell their wine into other countries. A big reason for that were wine tariffs imposed by China in 2020. Overnight, China went from being Australia's biggest overseas wine market to a very small one. So lots of factors playing into this, those tariffs from China and also a global downturn in wine consumption. Tastes are changing. Many younger people simply don't share the habits of their parents. There are health concerns, the popularity of non-alcoholic beverages and also speciality beer really eating in to wine consumption. There was a report from the International Organization of Vine and Wine. This is an industry body. It showed that global consumption of wine last year was 221 million hectolitres. Now, a hectolitre is 100 litres, so 221 million hectolitres sounds an awful lot of wine to be drunk last year, but it is in fact the lowest level of wine consumption since 1996. Already we're seeing millions of vines being ripped out of the ground because it's simply not economic for growers to produce grapes in the way that they once did. Australia simply is being hit hard by this global downturn in wine consumption.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. Back again to the top of the world. One man's job, another's dream. The words of Nepalese Sherpa Kami Rita, who on Sunday morning beat his own record by reaching the summit of Mount Everest for the 29th time. Navin Singhakka is the BBC World Service environment correspondent. He told Oliver Conway that the so-called Everest man, who's been tackling the world's tallest mountain for 30 years, isn't finished with climbing.
I just had a quick chat with the officials in Kathmandu, the Department of Tourism Mountaineering section, and they told me that he is back after his 29th successful summit and he might go back for his 30th attempt this season with another team. So, you know, that's what he does. No wonder he's known as Everest Man.
Yeah, why does he want to keep going up the world's tallest mountain? Doesn't it get a bit boring? Aren't there other challenges he'd like to pursue?
Well, the thing is, this is his bread and butter, number one. So that the more he does, the more he earns. As simple as that. Also, let's not forget that climbing Mount Everest for a record number of time, that status, that position, that fame is always there. And then also the third factor, competition. If he doesn't do it, somebody else is chasing him. So there is a kind of pressure that pushes these people up there. But then, of course, there are some who decide not to do it again. They retire. But he hasn't done that yet.
And over the years that he's been doing it, how has that journey up to the summit of the world, how has that changed?
There are two things here. First of all, when it comes to rope fixing, ladder fixing, we all know that Mount Everest is the highest peak in the world. Technically, it is not as difficult as, say, the second highest peak in the world, K2 in Pakistan, because it's all fixed, the rope, the ladder. I'm not saying that's easy, but comparatively, it's easy. That is why so many people attempt to go. But at the same time, what climate change, global warming is doing, how it is changing those landscape, the Khumbu ice fall, you know, it's becoming increasingly treacherous. And then mountaineers finding water flowing at Camp 2, Camp 3. These are significant challenges. That is why, for instance, this time, the Nepalese government for the first time allowed helicopters to ferry all this equipment right up to Camp 1 or Camp 2, avoiding the tricky Khumbu ice fall. So that is a changing thing. How dangerous it becomes, it remains unknown.
Navin Singh Khadka. Now, from towering mountains to other much smaller rock formations, it's the most famous painting in the world and still shrouded in mystery. Leonardo da Vinci's Mona Lisa is best known for her enigmatic smile, but more than 500 years on from her creation, questions still remain about many elements in the portrait. Now, one of those mysteries may have been solved. The geologist and Renaissance art historian Anne Pizzaruso has used her two fields of expertise to identify what she says is the location of the background landscape. And she presented her findings at a conference in northern Italy this weekend. She told Lise Doucette about her discovery.
I'm a geologist, and I started studying Leonardo da Vinci. And what I found out is I always thought he was just an artist, but he's a great geologist. I consider him the father of geology. And when I started studying it, I came to Italy and I followed in his footsteps, and I could look at his paintings and his drawings, and I could see the landscape even after all these years.
Well, you're rewriting art history. Da Vinci, the geologist.
I know, and a geologist. Isn't it great?
So tell us what your conclusion is. Where was it?
What happened was when I first came to this area around Lecco and Lake Como, this is where Leonardo spent a great deal of time because he was trying to build a canal from Milan up to Lake Como. And he couldn't do it because there were certain sections where it was too rocky. And so I went into the mountains with a wonderful alpine guide. I'm a city slicker from New York. So it was really something out of a movie. We went to try to find all of these places, and we actually found it. One of Leonardo's trademarks is geological accuracy. You look at any painting where he had rocks or botany, and it's perfectly natural, perfectly identifiable. That's one of his trademarks, is geological and botanical accuracy. And when we came to Lecco, I looked, because I had all my art books, and I said, well, you know, this is the area where he painted the Mona Lisa. But I really didn't do anything with it. I would tell different friends about it. But finally, when my art history colleague Jacques Franck in Paris is doing the definitive work on Leonardo, he asked me to look into it. And I did. And I found out that everybody was just looking at bridges, which it's like looking for a Mini Cooper. They're all over the place in Italy. And you have to have a bridge, but you have to have also the geology and the lake. And it was here. And now with all of the new instruments that we have with Google Map, Google Earth, and different drones, it all fell into place.
Geologist and Renaissance art historian Anne Pizzaruso. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ricardo McCarthy, and the producer was Isabella Jewell. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
So, how did it happen?
Well, actually, that's a really important question.
The two countries were essentially enemies.
That is, of course, an allegation that has been levelled.
Everybody had a different definition of what the problem was.
Let's remember the background of all these.
The Explanation is the podcast from the BBC World Service making sense of the big stories.
We're finding out why.
What is the evidence?
Let's analyse it.
Search for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.